He knew Persian and Chinese. He served at the Ilkhan court in Tabriz, and he took it upon himself to translate many works on Chinese statecraft into Persian. He also set a standard for literary Persian. So in these exchanges, it wasn't all captives. It wasn't all just hardship. Although I don't want to minimize that, and I can say in any of these deportations, the older and the younger ones clearly suffered and died in great numbers. Having evacuated from the city of New Orleans in the so-called evacuation from Hurricane Katrina, I have direct experience what any quote-unquote evacuation means. The deportations of the Mongols were probably on a whole other order. The movement of these people, the imposing of an imperial peace on the steppes, also allowed for the spread of religions. Initially, the Mongols were very tolerant. I mentioned that all of the Khans initially were very pragmatic, that all faiths were tolerated. Genghis Khan rules on this in his Yasa. Although each of the four Ulus took a different turn on this. For instance, the Golden Horde, the successor to Batu, Berkay, he embraced Islam and he became a pretty strong convert to Islam. He had contempt for the Russian principalities and Christianity, and the court at Sarai becomes pretty strongly Muslim at the end of the 13th century and really aligns itself with the Mamluk sultans of Cairo. On the other hand, their cousins ruling in Iran, that is the Ilkhans of Iran, the family of Hulagu, they too will eventually embrace Islam. On the other hand, the Ilkhans of Persia always maintained a cosmopolitan court. There are cases of Muslim Ilkhans supporting Buddhist monasteries. And the Hulagu and his initial heirs, and it took a long time for the Ilkhans to go over to Islam, it isn't until the end of the 13th century, they actually sponsor a revival of Buddhism across Central Asia and even in Iran. There are a number of stupas and Buddhist monasteries built. Now, these will decline after 1353 when the Ilkhanate falls and a series of petty Muslim states emerge in the former region, the former Ilkhan domains. But the Ilkhans pursued a very, very tolerant policy towards religions, and that was in keeping with the policies of Genghis Khan. Likewise, their cousins, who battled for control of Transoxiana and eventually got it away from the Ilkhans, those would be the Jagatai Khans of Central Asia. In fact, they were in general suspicion of cities anyway. They loved to tax caravans, but they didn't hang out at courts. But they, too, were tolerant of most religions. And above all, Kublai Khan. Kublai Khan embraced Buddhism. He was respectful to Taoism and the new Neo-Confucian traditions. He knew he needed to use the Chinese administrative class. But he always supplemented with Muslims, with Uyghurs, adventurers from the West, including that figure Marco Polo we'll be talking about later in this lecture. And in particular, Kublai Khan fell in the tradition of many conquerors of the steppes who have occupied parts of China, and that is the favoritism is to Buddhism, which is an international faith. It isn't just Chinese. Kublai Khan preferred the Sakya form of Buddhism. That is a very important school in Tibet. He sponsored monasteries. He used these Tibetan monks to create a new Mongolian script, very, very distinct, that was non-Chinese. And so monuments are put up in Kublai Khan's domains that are both in Mongolian, in this peculiar Mongolian script, as well as Chinese characters, no doubt to the dismay of the Confucian scholar class. And Kublai Khan's policies resulted in the spread of Buddhism increasingly across the eastern steppes. And when the Mongol Empire essentially breaks up and goes its separate ways in the 14th century, the religious policies have caused the great, what I would call, religious and cultural divide in Central Asia. Tibet, parts of China, the eastern steppes will fundamentally go to Buddhism. The old shamanistic religions will lose out, Nestorianism, Manichaeism, they will lose out. The Tarim Basin, the cities of Transoxiana, the central and western steppes, those eventually fold back into Islam and actually represent an expansion of Islam, particularly on the western steppes and in the Tarim Basin. The Tarim Basin is turned into essentially eastern Turkestan as the Uyghurs abandon Buddhism and embrace Islam in the course of the 13th and 14th and 15th centuries, in part imitating their Mongol masters, the Jagatai Khans. The one interesting development of all this is in Iran, the later Ilkhans, even the Muslim Ilkhans, were particularly tolerant, particularly of Shia Sufis. And it's in the 14th century that Shia Islam begins to make its first inroads in Iran. And in time, after the Ilkhans are gone and Tamerlane are gone, in the 15th and 16th century, Iran will be turned into a Shia state, which is a very, very significant transformation on the in Islam, because up until this point, Iran had been really regarded as part of the Sunni heartland of Islam. Now, religious proselytizing, religious change is one way of measuring the Mongol success, and some of these changes would not have occurred without the imposition of that Mongol peace. The Mongols also promoted travel and prosperity, particularly trade along the Silk Road and the complementary sea and ocean routes. You can get some sense of the speed and security by the missions that were sent by Western Europeans to the Great Khan's court. There are several of them recorded. The earliest one we have is 1246, when a fellow called Giovanni Caprini, a Franciscan friar, was sent by Pope Innocent IV, and he made a journey of some 3,000 miles across the steppes, actually in time to witness the enthronement of Güyük, and he did that probably on an average of 40 miles a day. There were all sorts of exchanges and swapping of horses, and he traveled about 110 days, some 3,000 miles. Some years later, I believe in 1253, it was over the winter, another Franciscan, a fellow by the name of William of Rubruck, who is from Flanders, was sent as the envoy of the Crusader King, Louis IX, who was hanging out in Cyprus and getting ready to invade Egypt. And he, too, made the same distance in about the same amount of time. These are extraordinary distances, and both envoys report the relay systems, the security with which caravans could travel. Now, no caravan would do these distances of 40 miles a day, but caravans could travel with some sense of security. They could move from station to station, from city to city. They could conduct business. And again, this is a feature of the later 13th and early 14th century. The fighting, especially in the early conquests, would have disrupted this whole caravan network. But the Silk Road does make a significant comeback. And so the prosperity on the Silk Road increases once the Mongol peace is imposed. Now, this upsurge in trade can also be examined by archaeological finds and literary sources by the development of sea routes. There are those complementary sea routes that move goods around the Indian Ocean to the South China Sea. They were never competitive to the Silk Road. They were always complementary. They go back to the 2nd century BC. This trade, too, expands. And this is shown by the dissemination of Chinese porcelains across the Islamic world. They become the rage of collecting later by Mughal emperors, by Safavid shahs of Iran, and the Ottoman sultans. Marco Polo, his dad and his uncle, Niccolo and Matteo, they actually returned home after 23 years in Cathay, at the court of Kublai Khan, by taking the sea route. And it was quite an adventure. They were shipwrecked. I think it took them from 1292 to 1294 to get back to Venice. They eventually landed in Iraq and took caravans to Trebizond, ships from there back to Venice. But it's to stress the fact that both sea routes and the Silk Road prospered under the Mongol Khans. Now, this situation led to some very important transfers, cultural transfers and transfers of technology. And what I'd like to do is zero in on that aspect of cultural and technological changes, because these had wide-ranging implications. Whatever we decide about the cost of the Mongol conquest and how valid the notion of a Mongol peace really is, I see four major areas where there were important exchanges. First is the area of astronomy and mathematics. And this starts with Genghis Khan, and most of the Khans, especially Kublai Khan, were interested in these subjects. One would wonder why. In part, the use of Arabic mathematics and Muslim mathematics, which had been perfected in Baghdad back in the 10th century, where Muslim scholars invented algebra, this was all brought to China to improve the calculations of astrology, because astrology is used to calculate marriages, all sorts of events. It's connected in both the Taoist tradition and even the shamanistic tradition. So there was a practical concern here. It wasn't just an interest, a dispassionate interest in math and science. Nonetheless, this exchange brought a Muslim science to the attention of the Chinese. And in turn, Chinese calculations and science was sent back. In this exchange, the court of Kublai Khan at Datu, the future city of Beijing, and the Ilkhan court were all important. And that fellow, Rashid al-Din, the scholar in residence at the Ilkhan court, played a very important role in that exchange, and he was involved in using a number of these sources. Another area of exchange was in geography, cartography, history, map making. There was, again, an exchange between the two great Mongol courts in Iran and China. Rashid al-Adin was in the forefront of this. He wrote that universal history that contains a lot of information out of the secret history of the Mongols, that is, the quasi-biography of Genghis Khan. That indicates that Rashid al-Adin had translators, that he was able to consult some of the originals. He also had access to all sorts of Hindu works because he has information on India that is quite good. And in addition, he shows a range of interest in geography, mathematics, subjects that we today would call anthropology, that was astonishing, far beyond the narrow kind of chronicles that you got in the early Islamic period, which simply reported victory after victory, the expansion of Dar al-Islam, temporary setbacks, but always great victories. This was a serious work. And the geography meant that both the Chinese and the Muslim world had very, very accurate information on map making and cartography. There is a famous Ming admiral. His name is Ma Huan. He sets out in 1413 in sort of a voyage of discovery and exploration down the South China Sea. He gets to India. He actually gets all the way to Baghdad. He's a subject of the Ming Emperor of China, but he also speaks Arabic, and he is a Muslim. He clearly had maps far superior than most maps that the great navigators of the period of European discovery had, starting with Christopher Columbus. It was extraordinary how good their map making was, and that was a result, again, of that interchange between the Mongol courts, where the Chinese and the Muslim world came into contact, two of the great civilizations on the Eurasian landmass. Another area of exchange was in all sorts of information about medicine, about food, plants. I mentioned some of this was practical, that is, grapes and fruit trees were brought by the Muslim world to China. In turn, various items that were well-known in Chinese cuisine, such as tea, black pepper, cinnamon, these were real luxuries. They become available in the Islamic world, and both worlds improve their diet and cuisine substantially. There are major translations done on works on cultivation and all sorts of information on aromatics, on medicines and spices. And what happens is the Mongol conquest puts together two of the great medical traditions at the time, that is the Chinese and the Islamic, and the Islamic is really, really quite sophisticated, and the result is improvement on both ends. Finally, there's the matter of technology. I should mention in passing, the idea that pasta went from China to Europe compliments of Marco Polo is a total myth. The pasta was known in Europe in the 9th century from that was devised in the Islamic world. So you should really delete that one from the categories. On the other hand, the last area I want to talk about is technology. And in that area, there was a very, very curious exchange. One of the biggest items is block printing and paper. This is devised by the Chinese. It's particularly perfected in the Sung period. And block printing becomes available in the Islamic world. Actually, the Ilkhans of Tabriz use it to issue paper money in imitation of the Sung. Paper money and letters of credit. This is an experiment that is abandoned after 1353, but is a very significant and interesting experiment in fiduciary currency. The final one, and the one that everyone knows, is gunpowder. Gunpowder goes back as early as the Han period. The Mongols encountered it among the incendiaries used against them in the great sieges on the Yangtze River. And black gunpowder is also spread across the Eurasian steppes. However, it is very curious that this is probably the only significant transfer of technology or culture received by the Europeans. The Western Europeans are fascinated with this. And Roger Bacon, in his Opus Maius, makes reference, it's probably one of the earliest references to gunpowder. And already in 1346, King Edward III of England has early cannons. And for some reason, the Europeans managed to enclose the gunpowder into these tubes, these early bombards, and create artillery. The Mongols, the Chinese, the Muslim world never came up with this. One speculation, and again, it's a bit fanciful, is that the European smiths were familiar with casting bronze and brass bells. You kick a bell over, you got an early bombard that is cannon. Whether it's true or not, we don't know. But in the 14th century, by the middle of the 14th century, the Europeans are casting early guns and are beginning to create artillery that can knock down walls. Now, most of the rest of the Eurasian rulers like cannons. The Ottoman sultans, the Mughal emperors, eventually the Chinese even get them, compliments of the Jesuits, and they knock down walls and destroy nobles and obnoxious people you want to bring under your control. On the other hand, it was the Europeans who then took gunpowder and created handheld firearms and mounted this artillery on ocean-going vessels. And starting from, really, from the end of the 15th century on, with those military advantages, essentially conquered the world. Oh, one could argue that sees the expansion of European imperialism. Complements of the gunpowder they received from the Mongols. Probably the only significant thing the Europeans learned under the Mongol peace. Another and final note I want to end with is Marco Polo. There are a lot of travelers to the Mongol courts, a lot of tales, but Marco Polo occupies a special position. Some even doubt he existed or he even went to China. The work he wrote, Les Merveilles du Monde, The Marvels of the World, usually translated as The Travels of Marco Polo, chronicled 23 years of service at the court of Kublai Khan. We can't pin him to any name in Chinese sources. There have been a couple identifications. He may have run a salt monopoly. He clearly was a minor official and exaggerates his role. And he hooked up with his father and uncle who had done an earlier travel to the Mongol court to represent the commercial interests of the Republic of St. Mark, that is Venice. But whatever the actual details of Marco Polo's career, really pale in the fact of what he wrote. And we actually have to thank the Genoese for this, because when he returned, he got captured in 1298 in a naval battle and languished in a Genoese prison and dictated his account. And we're not so sure how much of this account was altered, edited, and embroidered. It was actually published by a fellow prisoner, Rusticello of Pisa, who wrote it in French, because French was widely well known in Europe as a commercial and as a crusading language, and it was an instant success. It was translated into all sorts of vernaculars, and there are a lot of fanciful tales, and clearly Marco is not above exaggerating his role. There are many questionable aspects of it. Nonetheless, this account replaced all the fanciful notions of the East, the Far East, of India, and even of the Islamic world. Christian Europe had very little information outside of its immediate area. Much of it were wild tales from classical antiquity, legends, the stories of Prester John. That was now displaced by a description of a real great kingdom in Cathay, a real capital, Xanadu, and these became goals for the Europeans to seek out. And it is Marco Polo's work, according to Christopher Columbus, that inspired him to make his great first voyage of discovery. And so besides gunpowder, perhaps the second greatest gift from the Mongol peace to the Europeans was this vision of the Far East of Cathay, because Europeans set out in search of this image and then carried out one of the greatest expansions of all time, the great imperial expansion across the globe's oceans.
Lecture 33, Conversion and Assimilation.
In this lecture, I want to look at the essentially a passing of the Mongol peace and the Mongol Empire. We really can't study the Mongol Empire as a decline and fall the way some have done with the Roman Empire. In effect, we look at issues of largely conversion and assimilation. So this lecture builds on the lecture that dealt with the Mongol peace, the prosperity, the cultural exchange, the dissemination of religions across Eurasia in the 13th and 14th centuries. And what I want to achieve in this lecture is some understanding how the four ulus, that is the domains of Kublai Khan at his death in 1294, which embraced the Mongol homeland, essentially Tibet and China, the middle ulus, that is the central steppes in the Tarim Basin in the hands of the Jagatai rulers, the Jagatai Khans, the Ilkhans of Persia and Transoxiana, that is the family of Hulagu, and finally, the so-called Golden Horde, that is the descendants of Batu ruling the western steppes and with a hegemony over the Orthodox Russian principalities in the forest zone. How did these four areas change? How did they fall away from the Mongol imperial legacy? In effect, how and even did they fall in any kind of meaningful sense? Well, it is best to look at China first. As I've stated throughout, the events on the Eastern Steppes and its interaction with Chinese civilization have for so long dictated so much of the history on the Eurasian Steppes and its wider ramifications for Eurasian civilizations. Let's go back to Kublai Khan and look at his situation in 1271 when he had essentially proclaimed himself emperor and had taken that Chinese dynastic name, the Yuan family, a name that would resonate with the Confucian scholar class, the so-called Shi. Those would be the men who had gone through the imperial examination system as it had been formalized by the Song emperors. They knew their Confucian classics. They engaged in calligraphy. They understood all of the aesthetics and the moral qualities of the canon of Confucian texts. That was a direct appeal to this group. Kublai Khan inherited a policy that was attributed actually to his uncle, Ogedai. There was a very important minister of Genghis Khan and Ogedai. He had actually served the Jin Emperor. His name is Yelu Chiu Tsai. He was a high official at the Jin court. He went over to Genghis Khan early on, and he served with Ogedai. As Ogedai conquered the remnants of the Jin Empire, this minister warned Ogedai, you may conquer China from horseback, but you cannot rule it from horseback. And that image I have used repeatedly in dealing with several of the nomadic conquerors, notably, for instance, the Parthians, who tried to rule Iran from horseback. It doesn't work. In the case of Kublai Khan, from the start, he made an effort to win over the Confucian scholar classes. He spared most of the Chinese populations. We did not reenact the massacres that characterize the brutal conquest of the Islamic world, Russia and Hungary. On the other hand, it was always tentative. There were several important provisions about this. Kublai Khan was ever a pragmatic grandson of Genghis Khan. He did not use the Sung examination system. Far from it, he retained the right to select his ministers personally. And this was based on loyalty and usefulness to the Khan. This is a major departure from the Sung policy. By the time Kublai Khan does this, it's been several hundred years, this class has come to expect that it dominates the running of the Middle Kingdom, that is China, and that it would be premised on those men who had the proper expression, who understood calligraphy, the canon, who had the moral character, who understood the way, the Tao, as it would be done, as said in the Taoist traditions, and above all, who would represent the emperor and his mandate from heaven. Kublai Khan feared that if you put yourself too much in the hands of these bureaucrats, ultimately it would undermine his rule. And assimilation was always a danger. If the Mongols became too accustomed to Chinese ways and luxuries, they would lose their military edge. And the numbers really told in this. The Sung Empire and the former Jin Empire together are estimated to be 120 million strong, most of them in South China. The number of Mongols and Turkish tribes Kublai Khan commanded did not reach a million. And from the start, Kublai Khan had to use all sorts of outsiders, Uyghurs, Buddhists from Tibet, Muslims from Transoxiana and Iran, Western adventurers such as Marco Polo, to staff various administrative posts. And this led to a basic tension, even under the best of arrangements between Kublai Khan and the Confucian scholar class. To be sure, Kublai Khan and his successors, the later Yuan emperors, they patronized arts. They were very, very active in Buddhist sanctuaries in China. There was quite a continuity in letters and aesthetics among the Chinese educated classes. There was not a suppression of Chinese expression. However, Kublai Khan himself did not engage in this. It was always done at a distance. The religion of choice was Buddhism. Kublai Khan also built his own capital, Dadu, which is today the modern city of Beijing. It means the capital. It came down through Marco Polo's account as the fabled city of Xanadu. There was a Chinese-style palace built there, as well as a Chinese-style city, but it also was the capital of the great Khan. He chose what institutions to patronize, who would be admitted to court, and the capital was far enough north that it allowed Kublai Khan to stay in touch with the steppes as well as run his Chinese domains. I mentioned one example of that was creating a Tibetan-inspired script, which was used in all the monumental architecture. It was not Chinese characters. We can document, going all the way back to the Xuan Nu, that almost all the nomadic peoples on the eastern steppes used the Han, the Chinese characters, to write their own language. This was an adaptation. They wanted their script to look Chinese, therefore it would be elevated. This is not the case with the Mongols. The Yuan emperors used their own script, undoubtedly much to the dismay of the Confucian scholar class. Well, the system succeeds in the time of Kublai Khan, but his successors were not as